Good afternoon, everyone. I can personally attest to how committed Dr. Meyer is to believing in a right to health care. After that debate where President Obama said that he believed in a right to care, he did text me that a tear went down his eye that night. So he was being quite serious. The one thing I want to point out, we often lose the forest for the trees. And we've had, traditionally in this country, a myopic focus on health insurance reform. And that's fine. That's an important piece to realize the right to health. But I want to talk today about how this impacts upon a particular vulnerable population, namely persons afflicted with HIV. The era of HIV exceptionalism is far from over. Instead of being united to alleviate the disease burden of 34 million people worldwide with HIV, 1.2 million here in our own backyard in the U.S., we've taken to the kinds of structural interventions that are counterproductive in controlling its spread. But that's not the story of the day. You know, our story of the day is the Affordable Care Act. What does HIV have to do with that? Well, the HIV experience, and HIV criminalization laws in particular, they highlight the gaps that we have in our current healthcare reform efforts. They also amplify the opportunities for a health and human rights framework to fill some of those gaps. And that's a very helpful guide as we go forward. The fundamental premise is that health is a social construct. And the Affordable Care Act builds upon this principle against the backdrop of Marmot's foundational paradigm of social determinants of health. But the Affordable Care Act does this somewhat imperfectly. And that's where the health and human rights framework enters. That's where it can help us out. And we can see the value of this when we look at HIV criminalization laws in particular. And so if there's one thing that I want you to walk away with, it's actually a term that Ben raised in his introduction, and that's the term incrementalism. It can be a very dangerous thing in this particular case, and we'll see why. So this was a map that I created shortly after healthcare reform came out to really illustrate what's a very comprehensive piece of legislation. And you can see there are many central themes that are implicated of accountability, patient care, equity, many stakeholders that are involved here, all kind of revolving around the central issue to address some fundamental disparities in health outcomes. And for persons with HIV, there are many benefits to this particular piece of legislation. We first have the health benefit exchanges. So surveys have estimated that between about 25 to 30% of persons with HIV do not have adequate health insurance. Under this current provision, 30% of those individuals will now be eligible for the federal tax subsidies to now participate in those exchanges and be covered. We also have the prohibition against the exclusion based on the pre-existing conditions. HIV is among those particular conditions that constitute a high-risk pool, and there have been some surveys that indicate upwards of 36% of individuals who have sought to enter that private health insurance market have been turned away or experienced exorbitant premiums, which consequently resulted in then not being able to get covered. So starting in 2014, that will no longer be the case. We then have the expansion of Medicaid eligibility. This is crucial because that will take care of about 60% of that HIV-positive population that's uninsured. So you can see how all of this starts to fit together to secure that access to care. But a central theme of the ACA, and a very important one as we go forward, is it's kind of its return to the roots of public health. And that's in what we see as the value of a preventive paradigm. Now, this is something that ought to be guiding all of our efforts in public health, but of course, that's not always true. But I'm hopeful that as we look to the challenges we face in talking about structural interventions, that we'll always keep this in mind, because when we forget this, again, we kind of lose sight of what it's all about. Marmot's foundational framework is particularly helpful. Many of you who have done work in social determinants of health will be familiar with this. He articulates three distinct pathways when it comes to the relationship between social structure and health outcomes and well-being. He talks about material factors, implicates anything from food, shelter, and clothing, to occupational risks or hazards, as well as that third pathway, which is that social environment, which has that synergistic relationship with health behaviors. It's that particular third pathway that I believe that we are not adequately homing in on. And when it comes to HIV criminalization laws against the backdrop of the ACA, that's the pathway that we have to be paying much more attention to. So the goal, I believe, and it's a very simple one when it comes to health and human rights, is completeness, not merely complexity. A lot of general comments floating around out there, a lot of very precise guidelines. And we see that of these three particular conditions, accessibility, affordability, are met. But when it comes to acceptability, that's a far trickier one. That's when we start going into the territory of something that's quite murky, because what we define as something which is acceptable is often in the eye of the beholder. In public policy, who's making those decisions? It's usually the politicians, who often do so based on political expediency with decisions that are not often, if ever, subject to rigorous ethical scrutiny. And the ethics of it is what we're lacking right now, because the persistence of HIV criminalization laws belie that preventive paradigm against the backdrop of these foundational principles of health as a social construct. And the implications for public health are quite severe. What ends up happening is that you have an increased likelihood of individuals who will not seek testing. You'll see an increase in the potential incidence of the spread of disease. And you will continue to see that kind of disproportionate impact on vulnerable populations, including minorities, low-income populations, and those particular individuals who have been denied access to care based on their health status. And so under any measure, what we see now are certainly conditions that are not acceptable by any measure at all. And so that's very important. So where did this all come from? Back in 1990, we saw the Ryan White Act. And this really set the tone for the HIV criminalization laws thereafter, because it made it a condition of receiving monies under these federal grants for states to have these criminal laws on the books so that they could prosecute individuals who were aware of their HIV positive status and might infect another individual. It took over 10 years for this particular federal provision to get repealed. But by that time, so much damage had been done, because you have right now 37 jurisdictions which still have these kinds of criminal laws on the books. Now, there is a silver lining. According to some analysts, they say that we've seen a shift from sweeping prescriptions to specific intent legislation. What that means in just common layman's terms is that they've made it harder nowadays to prosecute individuals under these laws, because they've amended some of these state laws so there's a heightened burden of proof. But here's the danger. We see a concession to the politics of incrementalism, and we see a distortion of evidence-based policies. And what I mean by that is because we use evidence-based as a very positive criteria in our epidemiological studies. But what's happening now in this context is that we are now deferring to the courts to define and redefine the criteria by which we will bring these claims against persons with HIV. And that can be very dangerous, and I'm going to talk very specifically why, citing some actual cases that have unfolded. But first, I want to start off with an example of a law that's on the books. And so here's a law straight from my home state of Illinois, where they prohibit engaging in those kinds of sexual activities without a condom while aware of your status, your positive status, and failing to disclose that to a partner. And the defense to this kind of a charge is being unaware of your status or the partner's consent upon learning of it to then engage in those relations. But the consequences can be quite severe. If you're convicted, that's up to 2 to 5 years in prison and up to $25,000 in fines. The legal burden, though, and this is where it goes back to what they call the silver lining, is that now the prosecution has to demonstrate specific intent. And what that means is that you have to demonstrate that the act was committed, simple enough, but also that the perpetrator had that state of mind to infect that other party. And so you've made it harder, but I want to take a step back and just make this clear. What the policy is here is that it's okay to have these laws on the books because it's harder to prove, and that it's okay because there's some sense of justice underneath it all, not looking to the fact that you can still prosecute these individuals under existing criminal law. It's the fact that it's HIV-specific, which is, I believe, the particular problem. And we'll talk about a very specific case that really amplifies the issues. But first, I want to make one thing clear. This is not a political issue that's unique to one party. In Illinois, the numbers speak for themselves. This is our House vote on our law, 112-0, unanimous across party lines. And this is our Senate vote, 54-0, again, unanimous across party lines. And so this is an uphill battle, if you want to advocate in this particular area that I'm quite familiar with. But I want to get right now into the details of what this means in practice. So this was a case that came down from the Supreme Court of Canada. And this is the direction that we might be going if we don't start to align ourselves properly. And so we have the complainant, and this came down last fall of 2012. The complainant was a male who had a relationship with an HIV-positive female, and they had a single instance where she did not disclose her HIV status to him. And then upon finding that later, he terminated the relationship and then filed a lawsuit against her for sexual assault. Now, he did not contract the virus, so that's one fact that I want to put out there for you. At the trial court level, they held in favor of the man and said that she indeed was guilty. And in terms of evidence, what was interesting was that they said both of the witnesses there were not credible. They just looked to a physician's medical record and said that based on a note that the physician had scribbled, the condom had broke, and this trial court said she was probably lying anyway, so she never used the condom, therefore we can go ahead and prosecute her. Now, the rule in Canada at the time was you demonstrate a significant risk of bodily harm based on two factors. One, you have the dishonest act, and then you have the deprivation of that partner's ability to then refrain from having that particular relation. And it was a very simple issue before the court. Did the prosecution meet its burden in that case? So the legal facts seem pretty straightforward. Now, let's take a step back into the humanness of it all, because we're here talking about human rights. So what happened to the humanness? Where's the humanness here? Here's the timeline of the events that happened, just so you can get a better perspective on context. This is what really happened in this case. You had this woman who learned of her HIV-positive status in 1991. 10 years later, she meets the man, commences the relationship, and they do have that single act, which she later says she did not disclose her status, after which he broke off the relationship. 4 weeks after that, because he found out he had not been infected, the man wanted to then initiate that relationship again. And so they reconciled, and they lived together as a family with a woman and a son from a prior relationship of hers for 4 years. After those 4 years, the woman decided that she didn't want to be in the relationship with this guy anymore. So she asked him to leave the home. He refused to do so. He physically assaulted her and her son. And he was charged and convicted of assault. And then 2 months later, he decides that he's going to file this lawsuit against her for that single act from 4 years prior. Vengeance seems to be more of the theme here than sound public health policy. And vengeance is not a very good principle to be developing public health policy. The court's disposition in this case was simply that the old rule in Canada didn't apply, and that we needed a new test to talk about this significant risk of bodily harm. And the new test that we were going to use now meant that we had to demonstrate a realistic probability of transmission. And you do this by two criteria. One is viral load, and the second is condom usage. Now, when the court was talking about viral load, they were very clear to point out that they wanted to make a clear distinction between what they could see as a low viral load versus an undetectable viral load. Now, the epidemiology is very important and the clinical manifestations, because an undetectable viral load might not be the case if you have fluctuations based on exposure to common infections or even treatment. And so the court said, as long as it's low, then that criteria is met. The dispositive issue in this case was the condom usage. And so again, that was the actual doctor's note that was put on there. Sexy, new partner, condom broke, consult to disclose. And the court said, listen, you have a broken condom that's not the same as non-usage. So it put aside the trial court's verdict and acquitted the woman of any charges. Now, this might have come out the way that everyone would hope from a public health perspective, but there are a few issues here which I think are particularly troublesome. The first is that we have condom usage becoming the dispositive issue, and beyond discovery and access to medical records, you have providers potentially becoming agents of law enforcement. And for those of you who are familiar with U.S. case law, this is reminiscent of a very disturbing history right here in the United States, and there's two cases that really exemplify this. The irony is that 50 years ago, there were states in this country where it was criminal if you use contraceptives. Now it seems to be the other way around. Now it's becoming criminal if you don't. In Connecticut, there was a statute that criminalized condom usage by anyone with a fine of at least $50 and imprisonment for 60 days. And the appellants in this case were the head of Planned Parenthood and a medical director of a clinic at the time. And what happened here was that the Supreme Court of the United States said, we have zones of privacy, and that they emanate from guarantees from our Bill of Rights, because we don't have an explicit right to privacy in our U.S. Constitution. So these implicit rights are created from our First Amendment, our Third Amendment, our Fourth, our Fifth, our Ninth, etc. And that these apply to the sanctity of a man's home and privacies of life. And I would say now, 50 years later, that it should probably should be rewritten, the sanctity of a man and a woman's home and privacies of life. And the more important point is that third paragraph where the court says, would we allow the police to search the sacred precincts of marital bedrooms for telltale signs of the use of contraceptives? The very idea of repulsive to the notions of privacy. And so it struck down that Connecticut law back then. Fast forward 50 years, and let's turn to the other issue which I talked about, which is healthcare providers as agents of law enforcement. Some of you may have heard about this case. It was at Ferguson v. City of Charleston, where it involved a drug testing program targeting pregnant hospital patients using the threat of arrest and prosecution. And in that case, the assumption of the purpose of this program was to deter pregnant women from using cocaine by essentially threatening them of criminal sanctions. And so the issue came up before the court, whether this, again, was crossing the line because they didn't need a warrant to execute these kinds of searches of their urine samples to see if they had taken cocaine. And so the court said, no, this is absolutely unconstitutional. But an important part of this was that it was saying that what you have here is you're creating these de facto agents of law enforcement in our healthcare providers, and that's not what we want to see happening. So the key points I want to make by citing these two cases is, while less extreme than that Griswold case, we are beginning to see an indirect and modern manifestation of intrusion upon those zones of privacy with this kind of case law in HIV. And while it's less blatant than Ferguson, we are seeing potential opportunities to once again involve providers as agents of law enforcement. We are missing the point here. I mean, we have to take a step back and ask the very simple question, are these kinds of laws actually promoting the population's health? Are they encouraging people to get testing? So, of course, I would feel remiss if I had a public health conference without sharing some data, so I made a little graph here. And I put here the HIV incidence versus the testing in states which have the criminal laws, and the next graph is that without the criminal laws. And so all these data points are just the states. Now, this, to me, is very logical. As the testing increases, so too does the incidence, because we're diagnosing new cases. The important thing I want you to contrast this is with the next slide. This is in those states without the criminal laws. So what's happening here? We're seeing a line that's a little bit sharper slope, and we have a wider range. So if we look closely at the data, what we find is that with those states without the criminal laws, we have a higher mean testing rate of people who are seeking HIV testing, and we're also seeing a wider range with a comparable minimum, which means that this whole argument that somehow these laws are somehow encouraging people to get testing or somehow contributing to that kind of lower rate of incident, it's just not holding up. In fact, in at least one state, they have over 70% of people who are getting tested almost. I mean, that's far higher than the highest in the other range for those without. So we go back to that foundational framework, and we see how it's so important to really look at that third pathway of that social environment and to see how it's affected by those laws and policies that are deeply rooted in that particular framework and influence that and are influenced by it as well. So wrapping up here, I want to drive home this point that these three issues of accessibility and affordability, two of which have been met, but it has to be coupled as well with acceptability to allow for a progressive realization of that right to health. And just lacking one of these may undermine the epidemiological, the legal, and the ethical underpinnings of a sound public health policy. And so we have to look at all of those issues in the context of numerous subcomponents, whether it's politics, economics, epidemiology, ethics, and law. And not being able to do so will compromise the health of populations, no matter how progressive we think we are being on the surface. It's a simple framework, but not having all of those components accounted for will certainly undermine population health in the long run. Thank you.